This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Catriona Gold, and I'm a PhD candidate at University College London. Today, I'm thrilled to be interviewing Ellen Schrecker, who is a retired professor of history at Yeshiva University and a leading historian of McCarthyism. Her new book is called The Lost Promise, American Universities in the 1960s, and it was published with the University of Chicago Press in 2021. It's a really incredible work, which I'm very excited to discuss with her. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Ellen.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Right. So I'm wondering if we could start with you telling us a bit or a lot about yourself and your academic trajectory. So how did you come to write this book, and how does it intersect with your personal and professional history and interests?
Okay, I am, as you can see by the white hair, a member of what is called the silent generation, people who were in college in the 1950s and early 60s. And that meant that I was very traditional. I thought what women did was go to college to find a husband, and then if they had a career, it was going to be something like school teaching, and that's what I was planning to do. But I had a professor when I was an undergraduate who put me up for a graduate fellowship. And so even though I was ready to go into high school teaching, I said to myself, if I get a fellowship, I'll go to graduate school, and so I did. And it took me forever, but I did manage to finally get my PhD, but I wasn't rushing it, believe me. I had kids, I had a husband, we did foreign travel, and I didn't take my work very seriously. I was bored by it, really. I was writing about European diplomatic history in the early 20th century, and it just didn't keep me very occupied. So after I finished my degree, I got a job teaching freshman composition at Harvard. This is a part-time job. It became a full-time one, but the program required you to teach like a little mini course, a little mini seminar on a subject as long as you were teaching writing. And so what I did was focus on the 1950s. Then I discovered that I had nothing. It was when I had grown up. I knew McCarthyism was important, but I couldn't find a book. I couldn't find anything to assign to my students about McCarthyism. So after about a year of that, very frustrating, I decided I'll write a book. And I got a fellowship. And I was told by many colleagues, are you crazy? That's much too big a subject. Narrow it down. So I thought, okay, either I'll write about a city or I'll write about an institution of some kind. And it seemed to me that what I really knew was the university. I'd been there for quite a while already. And so I looked at McCarthyism and higher education and wrote that book. It got a lot of attention. And then I realized, well, there still wasn't the general book. So I wrote that one. That one also got a lot of attention. And I sort of became, as I tell people, Ms. McCarthyism. In other words, if you were to Google McCarthyism even today, you'd probably come across me. But I decided I really didn't want to sort of focus only on McCarthyism. I wanted to do something else. And I got a job editing a magazine about, it's called Academe. It belonged to an organization called the American Association of University Professors. And as I was working on that, this is a little bit before the turn of the century. I was following obviously what was going on within the academic community, and that itself turned into a book. So there I am with a book about the academic profession in the 1950s and a book about working on a book about sort of contemporary academic life in the early 21st century. And because I'm a historian, I, of course, always want the historical background of what I'm working on, and discovered, like I had discovered with McCarthyism, that there was no book about it, no book about academic freedom, no, really no articles, nothing about academic freedom in the 1960s. There were books about individual institutions. There were books about even individual fields like philosophy or history, but no book about the academic community as a whole. And so that is the book that became the book that we are going to be talking about now. The Lost Promise of Higher Education. It's a history of higher education in the 1960s. And I realized that I was writing the middle book in an inadvertent trilogy about the political history of higher education in the United States, really since the early Cold War. And so that's how I got to write this book. But it didn't quite begin that way, because I was also discovering that many of my peers, people who had joined the academic community, were young graduate students or young faculty in the 1960s, were on the verge of retirement in the 20-teens and were writing their memoirs. Now, I didn't think that I deserved a memoir. I was not an important player in the 60s. I observed a lot, but I wasn't an activist. However, my colleagues were. They were doing interesting, they were making history. That's what they knew they were, and they were very conscious of it. And I thought, I'm going to write about them. And it became what in historians call a prosopography, which is a collective biography of a particular group. And so I began interviewing lots of people, which was very lucky, because not too many of them are still around. A lot are, but people did fall by the wayside, as it were. And then realized that I couldn't just write about sort of young left faculty. That was clearly the main focus of this book, but I needed to contextualize them. I needed to put them within the system that they were having their careers with, that they were operating as political activists in. And so the book sort of expanded and expanded and expanded. And at a certain point, I realized, wait a minute, lady, this book is too long already. And what I published is not really the whole story, but we can talk about that later, because there is a story there. And people kept asking me, well, what's the main theme of your book? And finally, sort of toward the end, I realized what it was, that it was a conjunction of two very important phenomena that created what we would call the 60s within higher education. And one was the fact that this was a period of enormous expansion, that after World War II, the United States, American society essentially decided that they were going to try to offer a universal mass higher education, high quality higher education, to as many Americans as were capable of taking advantage of it. That was the promise that obviously is lost. But that was the promise, this idea that higher education might be available to anybody who could take advantage of it. And of course, what that meant in part was they were looking at a whole cohort of baby boomers who were about to descend on American campuses. And what did that mean? That meant not just expanding the number of institutions, the size of institutions, the mission of institutions. Small teacher colleges became somewhat larger liberal arts schools, and they began to expand. They wanted to offer graduate training. They become regional universities. We're seeing this whole system expanding and its mission changing. And part of that change is a kind of sense of upgrading of institutions. You know, we're not just going to be Brockport State Teachers College. No, we're going to offer a full range of courses and programs and become Brockport State University. And so this upgrading is taking place, and you're getting a new generation of faculty members, because it's not just the size of the schools, it's also the size of the faculties. And the faculty the new faculty members coming in are more, what should we say, intellectually ambitious. Many of them are coming in from graduate programs, even if they still haven't finished their degrees. Many of them will finish them while they're teaching. Earlier faculties were not as intellectually ambitious. They didn't think they had to write books in order to get tenure. And you're getting a whole different kind of culture. The academic culture is changing. At the same time, of course, the 1960s are a period of massive social movements, especially with regard to the struggle for Black equality and, of course, the anti-war movement once the Vietnam War escalates in the middle of the 1960s. And so it's the clash and the sort of confluence of that change in the size and mission of higher education on top of two, huge social movements, the anti-war movement and the student movement, which really sort of grew out of that in part, and this huge expansion of higher education. So that was the main thesis of the book that I found after I had pretty much written it.
Right, which is so often how it goes. right, that's so well expressed. This is incredibly ambitious. Also, sort of doesn't even quite sell the extent to which this is such a fascinating book, because, you know, as well as this overarching history and vision and story, there's just so much empirical detail in here, which is absolutely fascinating. And I think will be really surprising to a lot of readers, certainly was to me. For example,
you know, there's a lot we could talk about with regard to the Vietnam War. I mean, you say in your introduction that it's impossible to stress enough how thoroughly the Vietnam War permeated the awakening lives of student and faculty dissidents during the long 60s. And yeah, that's very clear from your writing. But there's also lots of surprising details that come out of that. So one of the parts of the book that certainly surprised me and I thought was fascinating was the way that professors, along with their students and sometimes administration, helped to resist the draft or what was seen as sort of unfair practices. And there's some really interesting intersections there with grading practices and, you know, other unexpected details. I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
Sure. One of the things that interested me was sort of the emergence of student and faculty dissent during this period. And I was looking for the moment when the anti-war movement began. And one of the things that's very important in the point that I make in the book very early on when I'm talking about Vietnam is that in the beginning of the war, nobody knew anything about Vietnam. Nobody. There, you know, it was this country that nobody understood. It had been a French colony, so all the sort of research, scholarly research, was in French. I had studied French history, so I could read it. But most people had no idea the background of it, that in fact what it was the aftermath of an anti-colonial war of independence. But in any event, what happened was when the American government began to escalate the war, began to bomb both North and South Vietnam, nobody really knew anything about it. And faculty members who were already themselves politically engaged, some of them had been active in the civil rights movement, some of them had been active in an anti-nuclear testing movement. In the late 1950s and early 60s, McCarthyism had pretty much receded, not completely, but pretty much. And students and graduate students in particular, and faculty members, were beginning to become much more politically active. This was, of course, sparked above all by the civil rights movement in the late 50s and early 60s. But also students and faculty members were concerned about nuclear weapons, the testing of nuclear weapons. They were concerned about the Cuban Revolution. There were a lot of things going on, and people were becoming more aware of politics and more willing to act on their beliefs. And when the Vietnam War escalated, it had been going on, essentially Americans had been intervening in Vietnam since the mid-50s, but when it escalates in the spring of 1965, what's important to realize is nobody in the academic community knew anything about Vietnam. And a group of political activists at Michigan, actually, University of Michigan, decided that what they would do, they knew it was wrong, they didn't know too much about it, but they would bone up on it. A number of them were social scientists of one sort or another, and they would give themselves a quick course on Vietnam, and then they would teach their students. What they had planned to do was hold a moratorium. They were going to cancel classes for a full day and just spend that day lecturing about Southeast Asia and why the war was wrong. There was opposition to it. The Michigan legislature opposed it. The president of the University of Michigan opposed it. So they decided instead of doing a moratorium, they would do what they called a teach-in and hold these meetings in the evening after classes. They weren't going to cancel their classes. And this movement spread. dozens of campuses in the spring of 1965 had teach-ins. And this, in a sense, as a result, it got a lot of publicity. And it really alerted not just students, not just other faculty, but the American public. They taught the American public what was wrong with Vietnam and why it should be opposed. It was a very important moment, and it's never been emphasized enough that the sort of activist phase of the anti-war movement, the first phase of the anti-war movement, began on American campuses with faculty members and some graduate students as well, teaching students and their fellow faculty members and the broader public what was wrong with the war, why they should oppose it. Now, that took several years for these lessons to sink in. But by the late 1960s, you would have to say the majority of the academic community opposed the war. Now, what I was looking for was how that manifested itself among students. And that clearly was through the draft. And the first set of student activism against the war was triggered by the fact that by the end of 1965, by the end of this first phase of expansion and escalation, the American military was having trouble finding recruits, drafting people. The pool of eligible young men, they could see the limits. And students up until then had all had what was known as a 2S deferment, a student deferment. In the beginning of 1965, the head of the Selective Service Committee, whatever it's called, the head of Selective Service, the head of the draft, decided that he would increase the pool by drafting the bottom quartile of each class, each college class. Now that create all of a sudden, a whole bunch of students are eligible, not just as they had been before. If you flunked, the grade F was a ticket to Vietnam, people viewed it as. But this was, you know, just people who were getting C's and things in the bottom of their class, not flunking out of school. And so they protested for the first time because it's the first time they're protesting against their school's collaboration with the American state, with the American government. This is the first time, and they're doing it on campus. They are beginning to sit in administration offices at important schools, at the University of Wisconsin, at the University of Chicago, at a number of major institutions, which is important here to realize that the student movement began on what we would call today brand name campuses, and then filtered down to regional schools and smaller institutions. But it was the big schools, the big urban schools like the City College of New York that had these early demonstrations against the draft and against the war. And actually they succeeded. In part, they succeeded because faculty members felt pretty bad about giving a poor grade, or as one professor put it, just because a student couldn't tell the difference between Pepin the Short and Charlemagne, he's supposed to go to Vietnam. So anyhow, it did show some that activity on the part of students could make a difference, because the government then not only dropped this notion of sort of the students who were in the lower ranks of their classes, but also began to think of ways around the draft. And ultimately, that is what killed the draft. Now, what's interesting when we think about the kinds of student activity that characterizes the 60s, you know, students taking over offices, students demonstrating, students shutting down classes, students even, engaging in arson or other forms of property damage, we assume that a lot of it is anti-war activity, which it is. Students were upset about the university allowing recruiters for the military services, for defense industries, for the CIA to hold interviews, job interviews for graduating seniors on campus. They tried to shut down those interviews, and often there were riots, there were arrests. So we're seeing more and more student activity related to the war, but there are other things that the students were opposed to, that they engaged in nonviolent direct action with regard to. Probably the most important was, of course, the struggle for Black equality. This occurred, here's something that probably people weren't aware of. I wasn't really aware of it until I thought about it more closely when I'm studying it, was American higher education was essentially segregated up until the mid-60s, that African-American students got their education at these historically Black colleges and universities, mainly located in the South, mainly under-resourced. They didn't have the kinds of laboratories or libraries or very well-educated faculty. And students in these HBCUs were aware of the fact that they were getting a second-class education. At the same time, the majority white schools didn't accept Blacks. And this you could see throughout American higher education. The school I went to, Radcliffe College, there were 300 women in my class, I think. Two Blacks. One was a foreign student from the Caribbean, and the other was passing for white. That was the case throughout American higher education. Tiny groups of students, many of them athletes, were the only Black students on campus. And when the civil rights movement began to take off, and of course it had its zenith in one of these HBCUs in the South, where the students themselves began using sit-ins, began using nonviolent direct action to push for integration of public facilities. This was a very important phase of the civil rights movement, and it was a very important part of the American student movement, very important. And in the 1960s, university administrators and the rest of the country as well began to realize that higher education shouldn't be segregated the way it is. And they began to try to bring in more Black students, but they didn't know what to do with them. And so what begins to happen is the Black students find themselves on campuses without having the kind of social facilities they needed to have a genuine college experience. They are barred from fraternities. They try to set up their own on some campuses. The administration won't let them. They say that's segregation. You know, as if the Lily White fraternities and sororities weren't segregating. You have Black students beginning to push very strongly, not just for more Black students, but more Black faculty, more courses or in Black studies that look at Black communities, that give these students and the rest of the academic community, the rest of the campus as well, some sense of what were the problems that the Black community was facing, what kind of history had occurred. So it's really opening up the curriculum. That's what they're pushing for. The main demand these Black students were making was for more Black studies, more Black faculty, and more admissions of Black students, and more facilities for them. These demonstrations often at schools like San Francisco State or City College led to the use of police, especially in at Black HBCUs in the South. There was more violence than anywhere else. When police came on campus during the 60s, that was the moment when the violence escalated, by the way. And I devoted a whole chapter of the book to the kinds of things that students were doing and the kinds of demands they were making, because there were demands related to the war, related to the university's collaboration, whether direct or indirect, with the military-industrial state, as it was called. There were also demonstrations and demands by Black students, but there was a third sort of criteria, a third set of categories that students were upset about that we don't usually think about as a sort of central to the student movement. And that was the kinds of restrictions that they themselves were facing on their own campuses. They had parental rules. Women were not allowed into men's dormitories. Women had to be in their own dormitories by 9 or 10 o'clock at night unless they were in the library. There were dress codes. My own college required its students to wear dresses. We couldn't wear pants below the second floor of our dormitories, except on snow days. Men had dress codes. They had to wear jackets and ties to eat in the dining halls or go to class at many schools. This wasn't just the Ivy Leagues. At Kent State, for example, a public school in Ohio, women had to wear heels and stockings. We didn't have pantyhose in those days. Heels and stockings to the dormitory dining halls on Sundays. So there are lots of rules, and students are very upset about them. There are also rules on the kind of political and cultural expression that students were allowed to have. School newspapers were censored sometimes. And probably the single most important student demonstration of the entire 60s took place over just this issue of the student right to political action on their campuses. And that predated the anti-war movement, in fact. That took place in the summer of 1964 at Berkeley. And it's absolutely central to my story for a number of reasons. Berkeley, it was the preeminent public research university in the United States, perhaps the preeminent research university in the United States. The dean of the faculty at Harvard at the time was supposedly quoted as saying, "The day the sun shines in Berkeley is a dark day at Harvard." In other words, Berkeley thought of itself as number one, and many people thought of it as number one as well. Big school. So what that meant was that by the early 60s, it was beginning to have a large enough critical mass of left-wing students and faculty to begin to take action. And they did, over the fact that Berkeley, although it was a major, major research university, still had a prohibition. It was more repressive politically than sort of any other big school in the United States, which is a major sort of contradiction here. But students were not allowed to recruit other students for political activity on the Berkeley campus. They could not allow political speech on campus. Candidates for president were not allowed to speak on campus in Berkeley. It was very repressive. And so when students began recruiting for activity in the fall of 1964, at the peak of the civil rights movement, the university cracked down on them. And the students mobilized. And the administration, they tried to negotiate. The administration would go back on some of its agreements with the students and was extremely repressive. And at a certain point, the students took over the administration building in the beginning of December 1964. And the administration called the police to clear them out. This was the first time this had happened. It had happened at a major, major school with lots of publicity. And what I also discovered, which was very important for sort of the future of American higher education, actually, was at that time, on the Berkeley faculty were a number of major public intellectuals who were writing about it. They were involved in the student movement. They were faculty members who were liberals. What you have to realize is many faculty members during this period thought of themselves as liberals, thought they supported the civil rights movement, opposed the Vietnam War, but they opposed students using nonviolent direct action against their universities, even though they may have supported what the students were demanding. They still thought the tactics were so bad, and they focused, what happened was they focused on the tactics rather than the substance of the student movement. And that's a very important distinction that not too many people make. They did say that, yes, we want a negotiated settlement in Vietnam. They supported that fact, even liberal faculty members, but they didn't support the students' demands. And they thought, and they were very, widely published. They had got a lot of attention because they were on the Berkeley campus. They saw the campus totally disrupted by the free speech movement. Even though they supported free speech for the students, they didn't support the way the students were demanding it. And so what you get is already in 1964 and 1965, a kind of scenario for the student movement that is very hostile to it. on the part of many of the nation's most widely published public intellectuals. People, they're not household names now. They were at the time Seymour Martin Lipset, Nathan Glaser, and they were publishing in mainstream magazines, in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, which was a very important venue for them. They're interviewed in the press all the time. And this is a very important thing, that this was a ready-made scenario. They're saying these students are crazy. They're irrational. That was the language they were using. They were saying what universities exist for is to maintain rationality, and the students are not being rational. But they were. You know, they were trying to get attention for what was wrong with the war, and they're not getting, nothing's happening. In fact, it was. I mean, the student movement did have an impact. When Nixon comes in, he tries to, quote unquote, he tries a program called Vietnamization. Of pulling out American troops, relying mainly on air power and a badly trained South Vietnamese army. And eventually, the Americans were forced to pull out. But it took over a decade. It took a long time. And the student movement is there on the front pages throughout this period, which has a rather bad impact on public opinion, because the media, as we know, likes conflict. It likes to have something dramatic, you know, students throwing rocks at policemen beating students over the head with their billy clubs, a nice quiet march. I went on many nice quiet marches during my 60s. I never saw any violence. There were people taking our photographs, but in fact, they were FBI member undercover people who were trying to, amass files on those of us who protested the war. But it wasn't on the front pages. The big demonstrations, the moments where the police come in, especially a school like Columbia, which is in New York City, which is the headquarters of so many television networks. During the Columbia takeover, where students were protesting a number of things, both Columbia's expansion into neighboring black areas, residential areas, and its decision to build a gym on a park in the middle of Harlem. So black students were upset about how this major university is just, sort of edging members of the Harlem community out of their homes. People were upset about the presence on campus of a Defense Department installation called the Institute for Defense Analysis, in which very high, very prestigious members of the physics department were doing consulting for the military during the Vietnam War. They were protesting as well the disciplinary actions that had already been taken against left-wing students. That was a major source of unrest, one of the major demands of students was against disciplinary actions that they had no part of. They wanted to participate in the actions of the university that involve them, that involve their social lives, that involve their educational lives. So many student demonstrations were often against the firing of popular professors, mainly left-wing professors. You'd get a demonstration, big one, at the University of Chicago against the refusal to give tenure to a very popular left-wing professor. So you're getting a whole bunch of causes, but what you're getting on your television screens in the nightly news is students breaking windows, is bloodshed, is burning down ROTC buildings, Reserve Officer Training Corps buildings. And the American people are beginning to turn against higher education. And what happens is a number of politicians realize that this is an issue that they can get support, that they can get political support from the public. And of course, the most important politician in this early period who uses this as a platform is none other than Ronald Reagan when he runs for governor of California in 1966. He's running against the University of California at Berkeley. And he wins. And what you get is politicians from then on running against the student movement, saying, university faculty and administrators are too soft on the students, that they have to crack down on them, that they should have brought the police in at the minute the students said, we want to, restore the jobs of Professor X or Y. And what do? They begin to turn off the faucets, as it were, up until the mid-late 60s. Universities could do no wrong. State legislators loved their schools, especially if they had winning football teams, and they were happy to pour money into new buildings, into larger faculties. That stopped. And funding didn't stop, but schools kept growing, and the amount of money that state legislatures were willing to give institutions of higher learning did not increase that much. And so what you're going to see at the same time, again, everything is interconnected. At the same time, the American economy is beginning to change. The sort of growth of manufacturing industrial jobs is beginning to decline. Jobs are beginning to go overseas, first to Japan, then to other parts of East Asia. And there's a reluctance to increase taxes. There's a sort of imposition of a neoliberal ideology, which says the problem with the United States is not the government. The government is the problem. The government is too big. We've got to cut down. We've got to cut down on spending for higher education. And what you're getting is a regime of neoliberal austerity that is depriving American higher education of the resources that it formerly had, of its ability to offer a high quality, universal mass higher education. Because if the state legislatures are not funding universities as they had been before, where do universities get their operating expenses from? Tuition. So that's accounting for this rise in tuition, rise in student debt, increasing inability to afford higher education on the part of masses of Americans. During the 60s, many schools were free. The University of California was tuition free, essentially. the municipal colleges of New York were completely free. That ends. And so what you're seeing is a more expensive university that is not getting the resources it once had. And what do they do? Besides raise tuition, they're not increasing the size of their full-time faculty. They're not adding new full-time faculty. They're adding what is called contingent faculty members, people who are part-time, who lack the tenure that most full-time faculty have, that therefore lack academic freedom as a result. And at the moment, the kind of full-time tenure and tenure-track positions that had once characterized higher education have shrunk to only about 25% of the American faculty. The rest are what we call today gig workers, but probably making less money. They're part-time. They often have to teach at several different universities. They don't have time for office hours. They have huge classes. They can't offer the kind of individualized attention that a faculty member who is there on permanent tenure or tenure track jobs. And the quality of American higher education is also declining, even as its cost is rising and as faculty jobs are now becoming gig jobs, you know, like an Uber driver, except probably less secure and paying less for all we know. You know, it's a very different system than it was in the 1960s. And though I don't want to say that the problems with American higher education today, which are legion, are the result entirely of a backlash against the 60s, that certainly played a major role in the sort of destroying the privileged and the amount of respect that higher education once had. It no longer has that respect, even though it's considered absolutely necessary for a white-collar, middle-class career. So we're stuck at the moment with a fairly dysfunctional institution in a fairly dysfunctional society that really needs what higher education could provide in terms of a sort of civic education for voters so they can tell the difference between fake news and real news, so they can sort of think about how they want their society to exist without these crazy, how they can assess these crazy, you know, conspiracy theories that are driving so much of American politics and really threatening American democracy in a way that, as I've said, because I'm always asked, is today worse than McCarthyism? And I say, yes, it really is. So we're living in a bad time. And at least what we have to do is begin to understand why. And then we have to take action.
Right. Well, on that note, and you've done a fantastic job, I just want to acknowledge it, but we talked a bit beforehand about the questions I wanted to ask Ellen, and Ellen did an incredible job of preempting all of them and going beyond. So thank you for being such an incredible interviewee on that front. But there is one thing that you haven't yet preempted, and I want to get in there, is that you mentioned in your acknowledgements that there was a lot of material that didn't make it into the book. Right. What would you have most liked to include in the book? And maybe that also is going to have some bearing on our present day situation with regard to universities. That's something you could talk about.
Okay, several things. some of which I've just talked about, which is this backlash against the universities. I mean, today we're seeing state legislatures in Texas and Florida and Oklahoma, you know, passing laws against teaching, what do they call it, divisive issues. What are those divisive issues? They're teaching things like Black history. They're teaching things like, sociology. They're teaching about race, the nation's racial past. They are teaching about sexuality and gender and so-called critical race theory, which of course they're not teaching about, but it's been banned now in K through 12 classes, as well as often in colleges and universities. What we're seeing is a backlash against what would have been the last chapter of my book, which was the way in which American higher education and American intellectual life was influenced by the 60s, by the adding of, Black history, Black studies, ethnic studies, all these ways in which we're looking now at our own society and saying, hey, wait a minute, what's wrong? How can we fix it? And that universities are the only place these days, especially as the media is continuing to shrink, as the traditional media is continuing to shrink. Universities are really the only places where these important questions are being looked at. And the questions are being asked. What has also happened as a result of the 60s, and one of the things that I would have liked to have put into the book, but really only mentioned in a kind of epilogue, is the fact that as the 60s is being, as movements for greater democratization within American society are occurring, especially the civil rights movement, the movement for Black equality, the Black power movement, and of course the anti-war movement, but the later women's movement, which begins in the 60s, but really becomes crucial in a little bit later, but certainly needs to be looked at here. As American society becomes more democratized, there's also a pushback. And that pushback is not just a sort of a kind of populist attack, but comes in part from the business community, which is afraid that there's too much federal regulation with regard to ecology, with regard to pollution, with regard to all kinds of things. They want to get rid of that regulation, and they're pushing back, and they're diverting attention to what's going on in higher education. And they're concerned about higher education, about research in ecology, about things that will require more regulation, actually. And a movement develops within the business community among a sort of right-wing oil people like the Koch brothers, within right-wing philanthropic foundations, to create an alternative system to American higher education. I hate to use the word conspiracy, maybe the word is a movement, but it's nonetheless coming from the development of alternative institutions that claim to be supplying expertise. And what are they doing? They're creating so-called experts who will denigrate the notion of climate change or talk about, well, pollution really isn't so bad, you know, things like that. They're trying to divert attention, of course, from gender issues, and we're seeing a number of rather serious moments here as well. Needless to say, and they've been active, this sort of right-wing crusade against the 60s, against the movements of the 60s, have been active not just in higher education, of course, but within the legal profession and the federal judiciary, and dare I say it, the Supreme Court. So here we are, you know, a week into realizing that we're about to lose our right to legal safe abortions in many parts of the country. And I should note, just for the record, that I had an illegal abortion back in the day when they were not legal. And it cost a lot of money. So anyhow, what I want to say is that we all have a dog in this fight, and we have to work collectively. What I'm doing, you might ask, what's your next book project? And it turns out to be a very short book modeled on some of the books that faculty members wrote right in the beginning of the Vietnam War, where they were explaining the Vietnam War. Well, what my book, and I'm working with a number of other faculty members as well, is devoted to trying to encourage faculty members to organize themselves and push back against these what are called educational gag orders, these rules and regulations, these attempts to censor what gets taught in American life, because we need this kind of academic freedom to be able to talk about crucial controversial issues and fight back. We need knowledge, and the knowledge comes in universities, from universities, and we've got to fight for the freedom of universities to do what they're doing. And so that's what my next book is about. It's to provide ammunition for faculty members and other concerned citizens to fight back for the restoration of American higher education.
Right, and this book we're talking about today, I mean, provides some incredibly important lessons, maybe models to follow, not to follow, cautionary tales, all the rest of it, for people looking to do that. So another thing that makes it such an incredible contribution. I think that's, yeah, there's so much more we could talk about, but I think that's a good place for us to end for now. Until the next book. It's been wonderful talking with you today, Ellen. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you everyone else for tuning in today. Once again, my name is Katriona Gold, and I've been speaking with Ellen Schrecker about her new book, The Lost Promise, American Universities in the 1960s, which was published with the University of Chicago Press in 2021. I highly recommend picking up a copy from your local bookstore, direct from the press, or from any other ethical retailer, or requesting a copy from your local university library. Thanks for listening, and thanks again, Ellen, for joining me today.
Okay, my pleasure. And if anybody buys the book, you can read chapters separately. You don't have to read all 400 pages at one shot.
Yeah, that would be a lot to digest. Anyway, thank you so much, Ellen. Highly encourage our listeners to pick up a copy. All right, until next time.